Hey everyone, welcome into another edition of the Woj Pod. My guest in studio today, Ian Begley, covers the Knicks for ESPN.com. And we talk about the Phil Jackson era, what went wrong, the exit of Carmelo Anthony, and the future of this organization built around Kristaps Porzingis. So here's my conversation with Ian. Here in our Manhattan studio with Ian Begley of ESPN.com, covers the Knicks and the NBA with me over at ESPN. Ian, how are you?
Doing okay, Woj. How about you?
Good, good. On your way up to the Knicks facility today.
Oh, yeah. Another big day up there.
What is, I mean, Ian, like, we go through, like, the last couple years with the Knicks. Mm-hmm. And Carmelo is, you know, virtually every day, Carmelo is the centerpiece of almost every conversation with this organization. What's it like with him out of the room, out of training camp in Oklahoma City now? Does it just feel different without his presence there, because it was so overwhelming to everything that went on?
Right. It's just a fresh vibe right now. And, you know, you talk to people in the organization and it really has little to do with Carmelo and more to do with kind of the position that Phil put the organization in with Carmelo, with the daily discussions last year being whether the Knicks were going to trade Carmelo, whether Carmelo wanted to be here, Carmelo reacting to something Phil said. So it was just this kind of black cloud over the organization last year for the better part of last season. And now, you know, everyone seems a little bit lighter, a little bit looser now that that's not here anymore. You know, Jeff Hornacek, it just feels like he's breathed kind of a sigh of relief now that he doesn't have to deal with that daily scrutiny about Carmelo. Is he going to be here? Is he not going to be here? What are you going to do?
You think back to the summer and, you know, sort of the transition from Phil Jackson, you know, Phil Jackson leaving, Scott Perry coming in as the day-to-day GM, and Steve Mills was the constant, the president is a constant through it all. There was a point, I guess it was really last spring, where Carmelo went from, I'm not waiving my no trade, I'm not doing it, as hard as Phil had pushed him, the organization had pushed him, they had publicly pushed him to do it. What do you think turned it for Carmelo at a point where he just said, I don't want to go on here anymore, I'm open to finally leaving?
You know, it's interesting, Woj, towards the end of the regular season last year, people around him started to say, hey, you know, we've never really heard him talk like this, but he's talked about this place as being a place where he doesn't want to be. He doesn't want to be around these people anymore. So this was like mid-April, right? But then I think as he has in throughout his career, when it comes to big decisions, he kind of went back and forth, right? You know, there was the thing off the court with his family. I think that changed his thinking a little bit about his desire to leave New York. And, you know, there were times, you know, I think in May and June where he was set to go, and there were times where he was set to stay. But I don't think he really changed his mind and said, okay, I'm ready to go, until, you know, early that summer when you were reporting that, yes, that Houston is on his list, that Cleveland is on his list. I think prior to that, you know, he was thinking about the possibility of actually staying in New York.
The interesting thing was, like, Phil, you know, and how it played out with him, Phil Jackson publicly had pushed for him to waive the no trade, accept the deal out. But it was kind of interesting. Phil did it publicly. He never really privately brought Carmelo in and said, and you talk to people around Carmelo, and I think they had always felt, if at the very beginning of this, Phil had come in and sat down in a room and said, listen, we want to rebuild. We want to go younger. Let's work together to see if we can find a team that makes sense for you. That Phil never really did that.
Yeah, for it to play out the way it did with kind of the passive-aggressive public displays from Phil Jackson, whether it was tweeting about a column that was highly critical of Carmelo, or, you know, Charlie Rosen writing in January that Carmelo has worn out his welcome. You know, there were things that really pushed Carmelo and pushed his buttons in a very bad way. And I think if Phil had handled it the way you just mentioned, doing it privately, so nothing is out in the open, but these two are on the same page with the direction of the Knicks and how Carmelo feels about that, it could have run much smoother. And I think if he had taken that approach, Phil is probably still in New York right now, because you combine the public mess that became with Carmelo and Phil, and also the Kristaps Porzingis trade talks that became public. I think you put those two things together. Those are big reasons why Phil Jackson isn't here right now. If he handled things differently and if he handled things behind closed doors like so many executives do, things might have run a little bit smoother.
And I think for Phil, I think he still tried to handle things like he did as a coach, where he would try to use the media to get a message out or to go after guys in public in a way that you can do as a coach when you're with guys every single day, when you have relationships. You could tweet guys maybe in the media. You could do some things publicly, but you were interacting with them every day. You can't do that as an executive. And I don't think Phil saw the difference. And it is a dramatic difference doing that stuff as a president GM versus doing it as the coach who's, you know, he'd have that back and forth with Kobe, with Shaq. This was different in that it wasn't just, we want you to adjust the way you play to play better here. It was, I want you out of here. But I don't think Phil ever distinguished the difference between executive and coach.
I think that was a big part of why things didn't work out here. You know, if you're a head coach, you say something to the media, let's say after a morning shoot-around. You see that player at night. You see him after the game. You see him on the flight if you're on the road. You see him coming out of the hotel. You have so many different opportunities to talk to him privately about whatever the issue is that you brought up with the media. Phil Jackson, you know, he's sitting at the top of the tower. He's not seeing these guys every day. He's not around. So I think that was one big mistake that he made, not being able to adjust there. The other thing is he has this vision for how he wanted this team to play, and he didn't do a good job selling it to his players and to his coaches. There was so much resistance with so many of the guys that he brought in, whether it was coaching staff members, players, resistance to the triangle offense, resistance to how Phil wanted this thing to play out, that I always thought that, you know, he could have sold this thing better in the room. That was one of the things that really surprised me, that he couldn't get these guys to buy in. And ultimately, I think that was part of his downfall.
Yeah, and the one thing with Phil, and listen, Jim Dolan made the decision to hire him, and Phil told him what it was going to be, which was, and I don't think Dolan understood what it meant, which was, I'm bringing a system and a philosophy, this core of belief about how we're going to play, and we're going to play with a triangle, and that's going to be an organizational mandate. And in Phil's mind, and you talk to people around there, Phil somehow believed that the triangle would survive him in New York, that he would leave someday, but they would continue to run the triangle. The Knicks would be this triangle organization. And it was so detached from the reality of the league, which is it's a pick and roll league. It's a different league. And he also didn't have, you know, Derek Fisher came in as first coach who had played under it and resisted in a lot of ways, wanted to run, you know, more traditional NBA offense. And then you hire Jeff Hornacek, who has never coached it, doesn't know how to teach it. Say you're going to run a system you've never run in your life, and to be able to sell it to players and teach it, you've got to be an expert in it. And so none of it ever made sense. And, you know, in free agency, it was, I think Phil thought, well, Kobe played in it, and Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, and so therefore you'll want to. And it was not, people just saw it as a constrictive. All they heard were other players complaining about it who were here. And they became almost immediately a non-factor in free agency, where there was this thought Phil's going to attract free agents, and Phil as an executive was not going to attract him. Maybe as a coach it might have been different, but he just miscalculated. And Dolan, again, miscalculated on so many levels what that Phil Jackson regime was going to be.
Woj, I think part of what you said goes back to your original point about Phil struggling to adjust from life as a coach to life as an executive, because, you know, there were times, and we reported on this, that he would get on the floor and talk to players about the triangle and the intricacies of the triangle and explain it in a way that a head coach would. And some of the players said then that, like, I never understood it better than I did in those moments when Phil was on the court, you know, talking about the offense. And, you know, there was a couple guys in the organization who always kind of, I guess, not poo-pooed, but always kind of questioned this mandate of the triangle. But guys in the room who questioned this mandate, when they sat there and they watched Phil Jackson talk about this offense on the court and his little triangle sessions during practices, one guy said to me, I've never been more on board with what we were trying to do than I was in those 20, 30 minutes when Phil was explaining this thing on the court. And that he just couldn't replicate that as an executive. So I think, listen, in a perfect world, if he was healthy and he decided, hey, you know what? My name is on this thing. I'm just going to coach the team. I think things would have been different, but obviously that was out of the realm of possibility given his physical limitations.
Yeah, and you said the physical limitations, and Mitch Kupchak was in here a couple weeks ago, and we talked about when he hired Mike D'Antoni over Phil Jackson in L.A. Back a few years ago, right at the sort of the end of that Dwight Howard, Kobe, Nash season. And, you know, he talked about when he went to see Phil, he did not get the sense Phil wanted to coach. He got the sense Phil felt maybe obligated to do it. The fans wanted him. They thought they had some talent. But he did not feel like Phil's heart was in it and went with D'Antoni. And listen, if you do the executive job right, it is a physically demanding job because you need to be on planes. You need to be scouting. And he didn't do it. I mean, I remember Kristaps Porzingis, and he'll get credit for drafting him. Like, they had the fourth pick. Kristaps was not a reach. Kristaps was a top five player all pre-draft. For the whole year, you knew he was a top five pick. And if New York doesn't take him at four, Orlando takes him at five. So while he did draft him, it's not like Oklahoma City taking Westbrook at four when nobody was going to take him that high like that. Phil never did the job, and he never put the work in. And even Porzingis, I remember being in Vegas at the workout, at his agent workout before the draft, and the Knicks had like seven the coaching staff and front office, and Phil was there. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time Phil had seen him play. And it's just, you're just shooting in an empty gym. That's all it was.
Right.
He had never gone to Spain to watch him play in the Spanish ACB league. Like, this was a player you knew you were going to have to make a judgment on and decide. And the fact that Phil had never seen him in person, and listen, they got it right, but Phil half-assed that job. And you see the shambles of what it is now. Bad contracts, picks beyond Porzingis that are suspect. We'll see which ever have any impact. He set the place back a long time.
So the thing that I always wonder about, and he's kind of talked about this a couple times, about how he, I think, was in talks to take like an advisory role with that Seattle franchise that never came to fruition. And he talked in one of his last press conferences about wanting to take more of a mentorship role with coaches and executives. And I just wonder if he had decided, let me just come in and be an advisor, or let me be the president, but let me put people beneath me who are going to actually, as you said, do the work, travel overseas to see people in person, scout a bunch of college games in person. I don't think he brought people in the organization underneath him who would have done that work. I think if he did that, if he brought a couple sharp young minds, some young hungry execs into the fold with him, and he was guiding them from afar, things would have worked out a little bit better. He didn't change the culture. He didn't change a lot of the front office. I think that was part of the problem.
He did. And, you know, part of that, too, was Phil was not really very connected to the league. He has been above the fray for so long. He wasn't a guy who knew who the good young executives were, or maybe even like the really good GMs in the league and presidents and the guys who have consistent success. They're always probing the league for who are the really good young guys. Who should we be looking to get into our organization? They all do that. The really good ones. Like, who do I need to be aware of? And then they're competing for those people. Phil was never part of that conversation in the league. And, you know, he had some favorites that he brought, a couple favorites he brought with him from years ago into New York, and then left the group there that was, you know, in place. There was this idea that Dolan was giving him complete autonomy to transform the organization. And he was not able, whether it was on PR side, medical side, a lot of the scouting, player personnel, Phil did not get through changes he wanted to get through. And Dolan had favorites that survived even the Phil era when you thought in giving him $12 million a year, you were allowing him to clear the deck there. And he didn't do that.
I would love to hear him just speak honestly about what he could and couldn't do, because different people tell you different things. Some people say, listen, he did have full autonomy. Other people will say, no, he got pushback on some of the moves that he wanted to make. So I, you know, just the reporter in me would love to know where the truth lies there. But I do think at the end of the day, even with those challenges in place, if he, let's say he didn't get to make all the moves that he wanted to make, he still had ample opportunity to turn this thing around. And I think the one thing that you have to give Phil credit for, and it's not some brilliant move, but it was a departure from the way the Knicks did business in the past. At most of the trade deadlines that he was involved in, teams called up and asked for future firsts. And I've been told that that was a pretty hard no from Phil, and that was a mandate that he kind of lived by, that we're not going to give up future firsts. Again, not a brilliant original thought, but just sound decision-making for a franchise that now needs all those picks because they're in the midst of a rebuild.
Yeah, and you know, you look at some of the trades early when he got off of – he wanted to get J.R. Smith out, and Shumpert was a part of that deal. And you look back at that deal, you know, and J.R. – I don't know if J.R. would have had sort of the second act to his career if he'd stayed in New York. I think the dysfunction of New York – brought out the worst in JR. And I think he went to Cleveland where there were demands on him every day by LeBron, by the organization. And he followed. He followed that and became a better defensive player. And so while they didn't get anything for him, his value was very low in a lot of ways when he was leaving New York. And Shumpert, you know, his career has been probably his most impactful years are probably with the Knicks earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at the trades and the other one early on that, you know, that trade, which did not bring back really anything. And then the Tyson Chandler deal.
Calderon back, Felton going out. Sam Dallenbear was the big piece that we were all talking about in New York and a guy who never really did much. And Wayne Ellington came back and they just didn't get much back in that deal.
There was a time where teams were just falling over themselves to get the Knicks on the phone to do deals.
Could they get Phil on the phone?
No, that's to get the Knicks on the phone.
That's what I had heard.
I do know one GM who said he called Phil once, and Phil answered and said the greeted him by name, and he was shocked that A, Phil even knew who he was, and B, that he had his number in his phone. But a lot of executives would try to get to Phil, found it very difficult. Phil wanted them to deal with Steve Mills. But they knew in the end it was Phil was going to have to sign off on a trade. And So the top guy in another organization wants to talk to the top guy in yours because you feel like that's the guy who is able to make a deal. And that was another problem for them. Even agents found Phil in meetings, sit downs, present. I mean, I heard some horror stories about Phil in presentation situations with players, unprepared, just disorganized. And sometimes he'd have Steve Mills in there who try to redirect him. But I know of a couple players who walked out of meetings in a couple different free agent scenarios and said, wow, that was Phil Jackson. That's not how I imagined he'd be.
Yeah, just I've heard some of those similar stories, and it just leads me to think again, if Phil was your brand and you had other guys on the ground actually doing the work in these meetings, I guess he needs to come into the free agent meeting. But if you have other guys kind of doing the sales pitch and then he comes in and just says, hey, yeah, we need you here just to close the deal. Like, things could have worked out better if he had people underneath him doing that work, grinding away as other successful executives in the league do. But that was never in place in New York. And, you know, we see kind of what the ruins are here from that era with the bad contracts that are still on the books now, the poor trades that were made, and how they have to kind of dig out of that.
Yeah, the other one we didn't talk about was the Derrick Rose trade, which I felt it immediately. It wasn't a reaction later when Rose had the problems he had at the season. Was that Robin Lopez signing was one of the best signings Phil had in free agency.
No doubt.
$13 million a year for a really strong, defensive-minded physical center, rebounds, defense.
Which is what they needed.
They needed. And he was, at the time, he said, wow, that's a lot for Lopez, and it isn't, certainly in this market.
No.
And what they did in that trade with the Bulls was, the Bulls had no market for Derrick Rose. They had nowhere to trade him. And essentially, New York traded another first-round pick because they put Jerry Grant
was in the deal. Yep.
So you gave up a first-round pick, essentially. And you gave up a great contract in Lopez that created the void at center for you to go out and sign Joakim Noah at a much bigger number, and a player who physically was breaking down.
Right.
Chicago did not want to re-sign and really didn't have much of a market, and you paid them at $18 million, and now we see where they are with that. But that deal, again, that's a deal with repercussions. Like right now, if you were rebuilding and you had Robin Lopez, he'd be a great, really strong trade asset.
Absolutely.
You don't think Boston would love to have that kind of a physical, defensive-minded rebounder, defender in the middle? There's plenty of very good teams where Lopez would fit in. And now New York is stuck with Joakim's deal, and they have nothing to show for the Derrick Rose year, except they traded another first-round pick, you know, and Grant, who we'll see how he develops. But to me, that was another trade that has long-term implications for them.
I totally agree, and some people want to discuss that trade as a one-off because they'll say, hey, Rose was here for a year. He didn't re-sign. We kind of washed our hands of it. But no, it didn't happen in a vacuum. That led to them signing Joakim Noah. And I think that also led to them signing Courtney Lee. And I'm not saying Courtney Lee is a bad player. I think he's a fine player. But his contract with where the Knicks are now, building around younger players, trying to get this young core together, his contract and his age, he just doesn't fit that paradigm. So you have two players on your books who really don't have strong value for you based on where you are as an organization. Courtney Lee, to me, has value for a win now team. So you're stuck with those two contracts. And I think the Derrick Rose trade really was the impetus to getting those two guys here. So it did not happen in a vacuum. It had serious implications for this franchise.
You know what is the secret of a well-groomed guy? The art of shaving. Founded in New York in 1996, the art of shaving has been helping guys look their best for over 20 years. The Art of Shaving has your total routine covered, whether shaving, beard maintenance, hair, skin, body, or fragrance. The Art of Shaving's award-winning products are formulated with the highest quality botanical ingredients, featuring pure essential oils. The four elements of the perfect shave have been created to deliver smooth results every day. Start by prepping skin with their signature pre-shave oil, then create a thick foamy lather with shaving cream applied with a shave brush, shave, and then replenish moisture with their aftershave balm. Finish off the perfect shave with one of their five fragrances. Each cologne has been carefully assembled for a distinctive scent. The Art of Shaving offers a convenient replenishment service that allows you to save on your favorite products while never having to worry. And now here's a great deal for you. Our listeners will receive 15% off their first order and free shipping by using the promo code WOJ. To get this offer, go online to theartofshaving.com. Use my special code, WOJ, W-O-J, to get 15% off your first order and free shipping. Visit theartofshaving.com for the special offer, or for a consultation with a grooming expert, step into one of their many retail locations near you. Kristaps Porzingis, if you're a Knicks fan right now, and you're worried about Kristaps Porzingis' future in New York, not just their ability to keep him here, make him want to re-sign here, but just his growth, his development this year on a team that's going to be really bad.
Really bad, right?
And should a Knicks fan be worried about how this year could impact Porzingis?
I think you have to be, based on the concerns that he already expressed with the organization when he skipped the exit meeting. Again, that's the red flag in and of itself. And now, you know, you're talking about a player, 7'3", so talented, a guy who so many teams would want on their roster to try to build around. But it's on this Knicks organization and this Knicks player development staff to really get it right with Porzingis. He'll put the work in. He'll do whatever he's told if he thinks it's going to make him better. But it's on the Knicks, who don't have a strong history of great player development, to push Porzingis to that next level. And he wants to see that. He wants to see that he's in a place that can allow him to reach his potential as an individual player and also see success on the basketball court. So that's, to me, that's task number one for this organization, for this season, and even into next season, is showing Kristaps Porzingis that this is the organization that's going to help him reach his potential, help him reach stardom, and help him be a winner in this league.
You know, the irony is, like, this is a league full of star players who have not wanted to play in New York. I should say this. I think a lot of guys want to play in New York.
In the city.
A lot of guys don't want to play for the Knicks.
Right. The city's a draw.
Yeah, the city's a draw in the Garden. And if there was any kind of representative, well-run organization, the Knicks would be a magnet in free agency. You have to really screw it up bad for people to not want to play for the New York Knicks at Madison Square Garden. And they have.
Right.
They've screwed it up bad.
Right.
And I think for Porzingis, here's a guy who loves it. He loves New York. He loves the fans. He can handle all of it. He's going to stand in front of his locker. He's going to answer questions after good games, bad games. He's gone out to other players in the league and wanted to know, how do I lead an organization? What's important for me to be aware of? And like, how do I hold people around there accountable? And he saw opinions. He really cares about it. And I think the player development part, like, he's going to put in the work. And whoever's there, he's going to put the work in the gym, wherever he is, and he's going to get better. It's the chaos around him. And then a bad team where you're getting drilled every night, where it's a dispirited organization.
Right.
And I think that's the hardest thing for a guy as competitive as him, who feels like, you know, he looks at a Karl Anthony Towns, you know, who's a peer, and says, look at the winning he's about to start doing. Look at the group they have around him. Look at Joel Embiid. Look at the talent they've started to gather around him.
Mm-hmm.
And how many years am I going to waste here on a bad team? And I think that's, you don't want to see him become cynical and angry, because he's such an earnest, upbeat guy. He came in that way, and you have seen him become jaded by just the dysfunction of New York. And that's, to me, if I'm a Knicks fan, I'm really worried about the toll that's taking on him.
There's no doubt. And, you know, fans, a certain segment of this Knicks fan base kind of looks at this season and says, hey, let's win 20 games and let's get the number one pick. And on paper, it makes sense. From the standpoint of the best way to rebuild an organization, it makes sense. But tanking has real consequences in a locker room and on a coaching staff. Because you're not going to sell an NBA player or an NBA coach on the idea that, hey, we're going to be terrible this year. We're going to get our brains beat in every night. But, you know, in June, we're going to have this young asset and we're going to be fine a few years from now. That's not how these guys are wired. These guys are super competitive. So how, if the Knicks are as bad as we think they're going to be this season and they're getting drilled every night, as you said, how is that going to sit with a competitor like Porzingis? You know, Tim Hardaway, this is a guy who wants to win games. He's not here to win 20 games and see who they end up with in the draft and wait on the ping pong balls. Those guys are not here for that. So it's just going to be interesting to me that if that's the way this Knicks season goes, how does management kind of weather the storm in the locker room? How do they kind of keep these guys being on board? How do they keep from losing these guys if the Knicks are getting hammered every night?
Can Jeff Hornacek survive this season with his job?
Tough job for Jeff Hornacek this year. He's in a difficult position because Phil Jackson brought him in. Phil Jackson's no longer here. Steve Mills didn't bring him in. Scott Perry didn't bring him in. These guys want Jeff to succeed, right? They want things to go well. But I think they're, just like everything else in this organization, Jeff is under an evaluation period right now. I think they want to see, you know, was Phil holding Jeff back? And now that Phil's not here, is Jeff the guy to lead this team forward? They want to see progress. They want to see this team playing hard for Jeff. There's no reason for this Knicks team filled with a bunch of young guys for them not to play hard every night. So if you're seeing them competitive but losing games, I think management is okay with that. If they're not competitive, that's a problem. It's a problem for the head coach.
Was Hornacek compromised in the locker room last year because players thought he was just a puppet of Phil? He was running an offense that they knew he didn't want to run, that Phil was guiding a lot of his decision making, and that they thought maybe our coach isn't strong enough to stand up for what he believes in, because now that's part of, you know, Phil hired him and puts him in a difficult position because of what he wants him to do and how he wants him to run things. He doesn't have to run the triangle anymore. He can run what he wants. Does that give him something in the locker room he didn't have a year ago?
You know, I'll say this, Woj. I can't speak for every player in there last year, but there were guys who shared those opinions the way you just laid it out, just because there was so much vacillation throughout the course of the season about how much are we going to run the triangle, is Jeff going to be able to open up, which he did early in the season? But then you look at around the All-Star break, they started running more triangle, and it was clearly, you know, Phil's influence. So players looked at that, and they saw Jeff as not having enough authority to kind of stand up and say, hey, Phil, I'm coaching the team. This is how I want to run the offense. This is what I want to do. I think if Jeff took that approach, he would have won this locker room over. But he didn't, and I think that hurt him. So that doesn't go away, right, just because Phil is not here. I think that impression, just from the few guys who shared it with me, I think it is still there. I think Jeff has to show himself to be his own man this year, and I think every opportunity is there for him to do that, but he's certainly under a microscope.
As I thought Jeff last year had the last – he should have resisted Phil and done it the way he wanted. Phil had hired Derek Fisher and then fired him because – partly Derek didn't run things the way Phil wanted. There were other reasons, but one of them was Derek wasn't running it the way Phil wanted it run. That there was no way with a new coach on a 4-year deal that Phil could do anything to him right away. Like Phil was on the line. You hired the coach. We're not letting you, you know, they had to pay a lot of money out to Fisher.
Yeah.
You're not getting fired in your first year, no matter how bad it goes. So do it your way.
Right.
And that disappointed me about that Jeff should have come in with that mindset.
Phil was not going to be able to fire Jeff Hornacek last year. There's no way that Jim Dolan is going to be paying Derek Fisher and Jeff Hornacek to sit at home while he pays another coach to coach the team. The only way that would have happened, the only way Phil would have been allowed to fire Jeff is if Phil decided to take the bench. That wasn't going to happen. So Jeff had the juice, right? He had the latitude to kind of put his foot down. And again, I think if he did that, the players would have rallied around him. I think that he could have got the locker room behind him if he took that stance. He didn't take that stance. And now, again, he's left in a difficult position where I think he's under the microscope from a management perspective. If this team comes out and starts getting drilled by like 20 points, 15 points, 25 points at night, I think there's a fear that he loses this locker room. And then you just wonder, do the Knicks make a change? Do they do so in season? Do they wait? Like, how does that all play out?
Are you surprised Kurt Rambis is back in that coaching staff in a post-Phil Jackson era?
You know, the interesting thing there is Jeff and Kurt actually had a conversation after Phil was let go. And Kurt said to Jeff, hey, do you want me here? You know, is this kind of still okay for you? And I'm paraphrasing because this is how Jeff relayed the conversation. And Jeff said, yeah, we want you here. So Jeff, again, there was an opportunity for Jeff to say, no, you know, Kurt, why don't you, we're going to move forward without you. Jeff didn't do that. You know, those guys, I'm not surprised, Woj, to answer your question, only because those guys have a relationship back from their playing days. So, you know, on the outside looking in, it seems like Kurt was forced on Jeff, and I'm sure, you know, to a degree there was pressure from Phil to keep Kurt on. But they also have this friendship, and I think that factors in heavily to the idea that Kurt is still here today.
When you cover games in the Garden now, and you know, like, there's fans you get to know, there's the regulars at the Garden, there's a mood in the building that you feel sort of through different eras. What do you think the Knicks fan feels now about where it is? Is there hope? Do you think the Knicks fan feels hope?
Not yet. But I think there's an opportunity for them to get this right. I don't think the general Knicks fan out there has enough trust in the organization yet to fall back in love with the team and to become emotionally invested with the team. But there's an opportunity here for Scott Perry and Steve Mills to get this thing back on the right track, to kind of dig out from under the rubble that was created under the Phil years. And, you know, they can do so by putting a plan in place, which it seems like they have, and adhering to that plan. I think, you know, there's this idea that you can't rebuild if you're the Knicks. I disagree with that. I think you can. I think you have to really communicate your plan to the fan base across the term of the rebuild, and you have to have players that play hard because fans will respect that. Yeah. If you're losing games by 10, 8 points, but guys are going hard, especially on the defensive end, the Garden crowd will get behind you. But if you're getting drilled and you're giving a lackadaisical effort, there's going to be issues for this Knicks team this year.
And I agree. And I think you go all the way back to Dave Checketts and sort of near the end of Checketts where he felt like we can't rebuild when he could have let Patrick Ewing just go off the cap. Instead, they do the deal for Glenn Rice, and they said, we can't rebuild in New York. We just can't. And I think NBA fans are smart everywhere. I think the way fans understand how successful organizations rebuild, retool, I think they have a pretty good idea how the cap works, who has a history of drafting well, who doesn't. And I think fans almost anywhere can be patient with knowing, like, we don't want a team that gets stuck in the middle, that can't get out of mediocrity. And let's, as you said, articulate a vision and hire great people and then let them do their jobs. I do think the place would be more understanding because they've seen how it's gone for the last 15 years here.
Right.
And say, this, we're just treading water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's that perpetual middle ground, and that's the worst place to be in the NBA, and that's where the Knicks, you know, by and large, have found themselves in the wrong real estate in the league. So, yeah, and people in the organization, you know, understand that to do this right, you need to have patience. And patience in the past has been in short supply in New York. So I'm curious to see if Scott Perry and Steve Mills have the support of Jim Dolan, if he's willing to be, as he said in his statement when they let Phil Jackson go, if he's willing to be hands off and give these guys the keys to the car and just let them go. I think if that's the case, the Knicks have the potential to turn things around here. And, you know, you look at Scott Perry, he, you know, people say and around him that I've spoken to say, like, This is his moment, and he's ready for it, and he's excited for this opportunity because he's I don't want to say like the anti Phil Jackson, but he's a guy who's come up, you know, in the scouting ranks and knows what it takes, the work you need to put in to be a successful executive. So he's committed to that, and I think that's where the Knicks fans should have hope that they have a guy in Scott Perry who can turn this thing around and get it going in the right direction.
Hey guys, do you hate going shopping for clothes but still want to look good? Bombfell is an easier way for men to get better clothes. Fully personalized, every piece has been handpicked for you by your own stylist. Your stylist will email you his or her selections, after which you'll have 48 hours to make any changes or even cancel altogether. You're in total control. Then when you receive the clothes, you have 7 days to tell us what you want to keep. You send back the rest. Completely flexible, you can receive clothes when you want and can pause or cancel at any time. And it's simple to get started. Here's step one. You tell them about yourself, your measurements, and your style preferences. Set your budget limits that you're comfortable with. Step two, you set up your order. Tell us what you want in your next order, like 2 button-downs and a pair of jeans, and then schedule when you want it, or let us surprise you. Third step, get a preview email. Your stylist will put together your clothing picks and send you a preview email. Cancel or change anything you don't like. We'll ship after 48 hours otherwise. And step four, you receive your clothing. You have 7 days to try on after your shipment's delivered before we charge your card. Pay for what you keep and return the rest, and shipping is free both ways. My first shipment of Bombfell clothes came in the mail this week, and I love it. So try it for yourself. We negotiated with Bombfell to get a great offer for our listeners. Visit bombfell.com/woj for $25 off your first purchase. That's Bombfell, bombfell.com/woj, W-O-J. One more time so you don't miss out on this tremendous offer. Go to bombfell.com/woj. Bombfell, open and close. So you mentioned Scott Perry, Ian, and his, you know, really his first signature decision was the Carmelo Anthony trade, bringing back Enes Kanter, Doug McDermott, and he gets a second round pick that Oklahoma has from Chicago, but that could be 31, 32. Chicago's
should be bad.
Pretty bad. So that's almost you could see it as a late first round pick, and certainly you can get a player in that area. What was your sense of the trade, of what they got back versus what may else have been available to them, and given that Carmelo had a no-trade clause and he didn't have to accept a trade to anywhere he didn't want to go.
So they were in a difficult spot because of that no-trade clause. The one thing that kind of struck me was, you know, they had a deal essentially in place with Houston that obviously was never officially agreed to, but I think they were far down the line. And then you wait several months later to execute a deal. I just thought that if you're going to wait this long, I thought the return could have been stronger. I really did. But they had this artificial deadline that they were dealing with, which was media day with the Knicks, because Carmelo did not want to be there. They didn't want Carmelo there. So essentially it was another trade deadline in these negotiations. And I think that forced them to take what probably was the best deal available at the time. They had the opportunity, though, to say, Carmelo, you're going to be here. You're going to play for us. We're going to see what your value is, if it changes as we get closer to this February trade deadline. The risk there is could Carmelo get hurt, then his trade value plummets. But they did have the opportunity there to see if they could increase his trade value as the season played along. They chose not to do so. I thought they maybe could have gotten a little bit more back in the deal.
And I think that's what the Knicks were gauging was, what will it be like if we bring Carmelo back? Can we handle the media avalanche every day, the distraction of it? And can we get Carmelo to open up his list to more teams and get some teams competing with each other for him, and also some teams that could offer some different variations of packages? And I think that was Scott Perry's hope. And as they got closer to media day on that Monday leading into that weekend, I think it became more apparent to Scott Perry that Carmelo was maybe not necessarily going to make it that easy for him once he showed up. And Carmelo had to do it. To now get out of there, Carmelo had to turn the heat up on them. He had to create some doubt in the Knicks' mind about, I don't want to say how professional he would be, but how open he would be to working with everybody. And like, you've got to create some fear that this could be a big problem for them. He did that. And I think Scott and the organization said, okay, what's the best deal we can get here? We have, you know, Oklahoma's on the list now, and Cleveland, and obviously Houston, which they just could not find any kind of a deal with, and just said, what's the best thing we can get? And Portland would have been, if Carmelo had accepted a trade to Portland, Portland would have been able to put a deal together that may have, I think, would have been very competitive, probably even better than Oklahoma's. They probably could have gotten a pick from Portland, mm-hmm. but Carmelo just wasn't going to the Pacific Northwest.
Right. So they were very limited in that sense. And then you look at what they brought back, and you mentioned it, the second round pick, which could be very high in the second round, which is valuable. And then you bring back Doug McDermott, who, you know, it would be a surprise at this point if they extended him on his rookie deal. But they're going to take a look at him and see what kind of value he brings and if he does or doesn't fit in the future of this organization. And then you have Enes Kanter. So it was a strong post player, but the issue with the Enes Kanter contract, to me at least, is he's got this $18.6 million player option for next season. I think it's, I don't want to say foregone conclusion, anything can happen, but I think he's going to pick that up.
I think he's going to pick
that up. Yeah, because not a lot of teams have space. I don't think he's going to be able to find more money on the open market. So then you're committing, you have already $90 million in guaranteed money on your books for this summer. You're not going to be able to do much in free agency. Maybe they wouldn't be able to do much anyway in free agency, even if they had the space. But you saw what Brooklyn did with its cap space this summer. They got creative. They traded guys into their space, and they were able to attach picks in those deals. So there are different ways to use cap space that the Knicks aren't going to have, in part because of this Enes Kanter player option.
It will be an interesting year at the Garden. Ian, man, we will, I'm sure I'll see you there plenty this year. Thanks for dropping in, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Woj. Hope to see you at MSG.
All right. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Woj Pod. A big thank you to my guest in studio today, Ian Begley of ESPN.com. Remember, you can subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of this podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows. And you can also hear the Woj Pod at 3 p.m. every Wednesday and Friday on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. I'd also like to take a moment to thank today's sponsors, The Art of Shaving and Bombfell. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Woj Pod. We'll catch you next time.